ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, Chinese property behemoth Evergrande ordered into liquidation. What are the economic and political ramifications? Also, fears the US and Iran are headed towards conflict after a deadly drone strike on an American base in Jordan. And tennis fans follow a time-honoured tradition, booing Anthony Albanese at last night's Australian Open final. Why do prime ministers keep turning up?
It is a great opportunity to be seen with the ordinary voter, and they would not give that up. They'd be prepared to endure a certain amount of shy-acting to be associated with ordinary Australians.
Thanks for your company. The slow-moving economic train wreck known as China Evergrande has finally reached the end of the line, with a judge in Hong Kong ordering the massive property developer into liquidation. After 2 years in limbo with almost half $1 trillion in debt, Evergrande was told to wind up its operations, a decision likely to reverberate through China's trouble-plagued property sector. There are broader implications for the economy too, and potentially the political environment within China as well. We'll have more on that in a moment, but first with the details, the ABC's East Asia correspondent Kathleen Calderwood is in Taipei. Kathleen, this case has been going on for some time. What did the judge say today in making this order?
Well, Evergrande is the world's most indebted property developer. It owes more than $300 billion and it's been in trouble since first defaulting on its debts in 2021 after the Chinese government decided to crack down on huge amounts of borrowing in the real estate sector. So this really has been going on for some time, as you say. The judge in Hong Kong today, Linda Chan, said that the company had made a lack of progress on a viable restructuring proposal, and that considering the months of delays, it was time to say enough is enough, and it was appropriate that the court order that the company be wound up.
Right. So what will happen next for the company and for the creditors?
A liquidator obviously will be appointed. Now, they could order a new debt restructuring plan, particularly to offshore creditors, if they assess that there is enough capital and assets within the company to do so. They can also investigate conduct and refer any conduct that they think might be illegal onto prosecutors. But we might also see that the company tries to appeal this liquidation order too. And its shares have been suspended today after already trading down by about 20% ahead of this hearing.
What does this mean more broadly for the Chinese economy?
Well, it's certainly not a good outcome. The Chinese economy now has been struggling for more than a year, really, ever since it came out of those very strict COVID controls. This developer is obviously a very large developer in China, and China's economy has really grown on the back of its real estate boom. But there are other very significant developers which are also in a lot of trouble, most notably the Country Garden Company, which is the country's largest developer. So certainly this will be one that will be closely watched by politicians and also economists within China and around the world.
East Asia correspondent Kathleen Calderwood there. Let's get more on the implications of the Evergrande collapse for the economy and for investors. Junbei Liu is a portfolio manager at Tribeca Investment Partners.
This is the largest builder there in China, and it is trillions of dollars in assets, not to mention this broadening out into, you know, insurance businesses in almost every sector. So it is enormous impact, not just housing. It's also the jobs that's being created by this company. So it is going to have a long-lasting effect on the economy itself.
How much of their investment should creditors expect to get back?
It is trading at about 1.5 cents on a dollar. So it is very, very incredibly low. It is rather disappointing after government repeated boost to the housing market and trying to get some of those inventory, those properties and apartments moving. So there's really not that much left there.
And what about China's reputation as a safe place to invest? How does this affect that?
Look, it does increase the risk profile for the country. But look, government is doing quite a lot to trying to prop up the property market. And at this point, looks like it is stabilizing. We have yet to see green shoots, but it is stabilizing.
And more broadly on the Chinese economy, what does this tell us about where things are going for China and I guess as a result of that for the globe?
What that signifies is that economy is going through its challenges in China, and that's quite different from the rest of the world where, you know, everyone's combating the inflation on, you know, on the other extent, whereas China is combating deflation and, you know, recession fear. However, there has been a lot of stimulus announced by the government in China. So we are hoping that, you know, this will be the last of the bad news before things get better.
That's Junbei Liu from Tribeca Investment Partners. How is all of this being viewed inside China? And what of the political ramifications, if any? Richard McGregor is a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute. He's a former Beijing bureau chief for the Financial Times and author of several books about the Chinese Communist Party and its leader, President Xi Jinping.
Well, I think the court-ordered liquidation of Evergrande has two important aspects. The first is it's, you know, symbolic of the train wreck that the Chinese property sector is at the moment. Evergrande is the biggest Chinese property developer in a sector which was worth 25 to 30% of the Chinese economy. So in that respect, it's a big deal. But in other respects, it's maybe less than meets the eye in that a court in Hong Kong is likely to have limited impact on assets in the mainland, unless mainland courts affirm the appointment of the liquidator. You know, a lot of the assets in China have already been sold off. A lot of them have been dealt with in other ways. So it's very symbolic, but the practical implications are a bit harder to judge.
That symbolism that you talk of, is that going to go down in any way with the Chinese families who've lost their life savings and are still without a home to live in? When they see foreign creditors offered, I guess, just the entrails, but still, of this once massive company?
The central government has, if they've had a singular aim with the collapse of the Chinese property sector, it's to make sure that Chinese families who had bought apartments, you know, homes off the plan, that those homes were completed. And they've been attempting to arrange sort of bridge, you know, bank funding to developers like Evergrande to allow that to happen. Now, obviously, only a partial number of those Chinese putative home loaners actually have got their homes. I don't know the exact percentage of that. And I think for them, the decision in Hong Kong will just be another way station in the fact that they've, you know, lost a large proportion of their life savings on buying homes that they'll never get.
So could that ultimately create problems for the Chinese Communist Party or for the president, Xi Jinping?
Well, this has been a slow-running train wreck or fire, if you like. So many of the problems which are symbolised by the liquidation of Evergrande in Hong Kong have been playing out for 3-4 years in China already. So it's not a thunderclap in that respect. On to the broader issue of how the sort of unwinding of the property market in China affects social stability, affects the standing of Xi Jinping and the like. I think that's a harder one to judge. I think most of the people who've lost their life savings here will be blaming the property company. They will be blaming the banks. They will be blaming local governments before they turn their gaze to Xi Jinping. I do think, though, that, you know, China has a big problem in finding another engine of growth to replace the property sector. And so if you have 2 to 3 years, 4 years of subpar growth in China, you know, continued rising unemployment, incomes which are no longer growing in the way that they have grown for decades in China, then yes, I do think that becomes a genuine political problem for the government. But we're not at that point yet.
Because in a way, the contract that's been offered to the Chinese people is you may not get the freedoms that are enjoyed in the West, but you will get wealthy under the Chinese Communist Party. You know, if the economy remains in the doldrums for longer and longer, does that become a serious problem for the party.
Well, I guess the main point is, are there more winners than losers over time? And at the moment, there's still far more winners. And the Chinese economy has slowed down appreciably, but it hasn't stopped. But over time, certainly, you know, a large degree of the legitimacy of the Communist Party has come from the fact that it has delivered higher living standards. And if they no longer do that, then they've got a problem.
That's Richard McGregor, a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute. This is PM. I'm David Lipson. Coming up, another big wet weather pattern is gathering steam. Could La Nina make a return in 2024? Fears of a direct confrontation between the United States and Iran are growing after a deadly drone attack which killed at least three US troops and injured more than 30 others. The White House has blamed Iran-backed forces for the attack near the Jordanian-Syrian border and is vowing to respond. It's the first time US troops have been killed by hostile fire in the Middle East since the beginning of the war in Gaza, and marks an escalation that experts argue, while concerning, isn't surprising. Gavin Coote reports.
Clashes across the Middle East were already intensifying before a drone attack on a US military base killed three American soldiers. The White House is blaming Iranian-backed forces. It's weighing up a response, and the world waits anxiously.
We are in a moment of true instability and insecurity. Again, that jeopardizes the lives of many millions of people.
Allison McManus, a senior director at the Center for American Progress, points out the deadly attack marks another escalation of tensions in the Middle East.
I don't think that they'll wait too long, particularly because if we know now that Iran is equipping its militias and essentially giving the green light to target American troops, that's not something that's going to go without a response for very long. But obviously it may be, you know, a number of days or weeks.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq, an umbrella organisation of hardline Iran-backed militant groups, has claimed responsibility for the attack. Its target was a support base known as Tower 22, which is located in Jordan near the Syrian border. Dr. Trita Parsi is an expert on US-Iranian relations.
I think it should be noted that we have seen about 160 attacks by these Iraqi militias since October 17th, when Israel went into Gaza. The only time in which they completely stopped was during the 6 days when there was a ceasefire between November 24th and November 30th. It's very clear that through a ceasefire, these attacks can stop, as well as the attacks of the Houthis in the Red Sea. Unfortunately, that is not the path that Biden has chosen.
Dr. Parsi is warning Washington will need to consider its response carefully and whether it targets Iranian-aligned groups or considers a more direct confrontation with Iran.
Well, obviously, this could potentially be a watershed moment in this war, and unfortunately, it was highly predictable. As long as there was no push for a ceasefire, in fact, the Biden administration has been blocking efforts for a ceasefire, we saw how tensions on four different fronts were being fueled by the violence in Gaza, in the Red Sea with the Houthis, Syrian and Iraqi militias, who now have unfortunately succeeded in killing three Americans, between Israel and Lebanon, where tensions are also boiling, and potentially even directly between the U.S. and Iran. And so this is a very dangerous moment because the Biden administration has constantly reacted tactically by retaliating without recognizing that the policy it pursues is strategically bringing the United States closer and closer to a devastating war in the Middle East. And that's the last thing America needs right now.
While Iran has denied any involvement in the attack, experts point out it's been able to maintain plausible deniability. Armin Seikel is an emeritus professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Australian National University.
And of course, that has been the Iranian position for a long time. But the way the United States and Israel view it, this is an attack which couldn't have taken place without Iranian encouragement.
What kind of calculation would the US be making right now about what that response would look like?
I think in the first instance, probably the United States will target a certain Iranian sites or the Iranian-backed militia sites in Syria and possibly in Iraq. But there is also a possibility of the Americans may carry out direct attacks on Iranian sites. And some American congressmen, including Lindsey Graham, have said that I think there should be a direct retaliation against Iran. And as they have put it, to cut the head of the snake. And and the Israelis have been strongly supportive of that. And Israel wouldn't mind to see the United States involved in a much bigger war in the region, because Israel sees Iran as an existential threat and would like to see the weakening of that country as much as possible across the region.
Is there a risk that the US in its response could be playing into Iran's hands? Many have made the point this is part of their playbook, using proxies to draw in the US.
Yeah, but it also involves a danger of escalation of the conflict and a much wider regional conflict. And I don't think that the Iranian leadership would be very keen to get involved in a regional war with the United States and Israel. But at the same time, these sort of tits for tats could easily escalate into a regional war, which could be devastating for the whole area. Not just for Iran, but also for the Americans and the Israelis, because Iran would be in a position to target American bases in Israel across the region.
The US has repeatedly clashed with another Iranian-backed group, the Yemeni-based Houthis, who are attacking commercial shipping in the Red Sea.
Gavin Coote reporting there. Well, now the dust has settled on the government's Stage 3 tax changes. What sort of tangible cost of living relief do they actually represent? One leading economist points out, even if the tax package passes the parliament, Australians will still pay close to a record proportion of their income in tax. In fact, it seems most workers will still pay more tax than they did in 2022. But what about those for whom every single dollar matters? Reporter David Taylor has more.
Australians are paying a bigger proportion of their income in tax than ever before. Gareth Aird is the Commonwealth Bank's head of economics.
Currently, it's at a record high at just under 18% of household income is going back to the government in the form of tax paid.
And the proportion of workers' income paid in tax is set to keep climbing over the next 3 to 6 months.
That'll keep going up until the tax cuts kick in on 1 July.
The changes to the Stage 3 tax cuts now means that proportion is smaller. But by how much?
The main message here is that households will be getting some tax relief, but they'll still be handing over a pretty large proportion of their income relative to history.
Gareth Aird blames bracket creep. That is, workers' wages have been growing relatively rapidly in recent years, pushing many workers into higher tax brackets. He's now crunched the numbers and says even once the tax relief kicks in, workers will still be paying more in tax than they were in 2022.
So every individual will be a bit better off from 1 July when the tax cuts hit. But relative to a few years ago, the average person will be still paying a greater proportion of their income to the government in the form of taxes.
So relative to a few years ago, Australians will still be paying more in tax to the Australian government.
Yeah, that's right. If we look at the September quarter of 2022, taxpayers were handing over on average 15.5% of their income to government. That measure has gone up a bit over 2 percentage points in 12 months, which is quite extraordinary, really. But we've had pretty decent wage gains coming through, and that has meant a lot of taxpayers have been shifting up to higher tax brackets, so they're handing over a bigger share of their income. That ratio will go down a little bit because of the tax cuts, but it won't take us back to where we were a few years ago.
The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, was asked directly today if, given this, he was planning more tax relief for workers.
Well, we want to bed down the tax relief that we just announced in the last few days.
But in answering the question, the Treasurer chose to focus on the average tax rate paid by workers, and this, he says, will fall.
The average tax rate goes from 25.5% this year to 23.9% next year with our new tax cuts. And so we are getting the overall tax burden down. We're doing it in a way where everyone gets a tax cut, but there's a bigger emphasis on middle Australia. We are returning bracket creep. We're providing cost of living help. We're not adding upward pressure on inflation. We're doing it in a way that's good for middle Australia, good for young people, good for women, and good for the economy.
And advocates of those on the lowest incomes say some of Australia's most financially vulnerable families appreciate every extra dollar they can get. Cassandra Goldie is the CEO of the Australian Council of Social Service, or ACOS.
When you're on a very low income, every dollar counts. It will pay for food. It will help you to pay the energy bills. We've got people who are going without the essentials of life at the moment. We have strongly welcomed the redesign of the Stage 3 tax cuts to make them fairer. And we also now want to see the increased job seeker to help people whose incomes are so low that they won't currently get any benefit out of those Stage 3 tax cuts at all.
Most economists don't expect the changes to the Stage 3 tax cuts to add to inflation. And given it's expected to fall further, the CBA's Gareth Aird says anyone with a mortgage should receive additional cost of living relief in September, the month the bank expects the RBA to drop interest rates.
And the work we've done basically leads us to conclude that even though tax relief is coming from 1 July, it's not likely to be sufficient enough in size to stop the Reserve Bank from cutting rates later on this year, which is our base case.
Official inflation data will be released on Wednesday.
David Taylor there. Ex-tropical cyclone Kirrily may be long gone. She's left a great deal of wet weather in her wake. Some farmers fear the big wet has damaged their crops. Others are upset they didn't get the rains they were expecting and hoping for. In the longer term, there may be much more rain on the way, with modelling suggesting an increasing likelihood that the La Niña weather pattern could return this year. Elizabeth Cramsey has this report.
In the western Queensland town of Dirranbandi, the rain is rolling in. It's the same system wreaking havoc on Wade McConaughey's property, much further north at McKinley, south of Cloncurry.
In about 48 hours, we're up to 305 mil now, which I just tipped out about 5 minutes ago. Yeah, it's a little bit too much rain. I was saying to my wife yesterday, it was sort of starting to come down, and I said, you know, be good if it could ease off, and she reckons I'm always negative. 1 minute I'm whinging, we're not getting enough, and then we're getting too much. But there is a fine line between enough and not enough.
He says too much rain can be devastating.
You get sort of 3-4 inches in this country and it's pretty good, and then sort of anything after that is just running off. And so it sort of causes, you know, fences will get washed down, can take out dam banks. Like last year we sort of had similar rain, and we lost two dams that we've rebuilt, and I'm pretty concerned that they might be gone again. But yeah, it's sort of, and if you have too much rain, the cattle, they can get cold and get pneumonia and die. And sometimes the grass, if the grass is underwater for too long, it'll drown. And then it's sort of, you can have a lot of rain, and then in the end, it's not all that great. And you don't have much of a season because a lot of the grass drowned and never come through.
Further east in the Burdekin, mango and cattle farmer Daniel Lafleur is breathing a sigh of relief after receiving around 32 mils.
We had quite a wet early January, even before the cyclone. We had a fair bit of rain in December as well, and it'd be very, very rare to not have rain in February. So we're doing quite well, and we're very much expecting more.
Dean Naramore is a senior meteorologist at the Bureau of Meteorology.
The focus of the rainfall is now right around that low pressure system, which is just south of Cloncurry, and also into southern and southeastern parts of Queensland. So first off, around that low, we're continuing to see very heavy falls. So near and to the south of Cloncurry, in the 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, we've seen falls of widespread 50 to 150, with some locations getting in excess of 250 millimetres.
And he says the wet weather is set to continue for a couple of days.
A low might get a bit of a wobble to the west and northwest, so that might start moving some of that shower and rainfall activity towards the Cloncurry area and possibly even up towards the Mount Isa area, maybe into tonight and into tomorrow. But severe weather warnings are current still for heavy rainfall for parts of northwest Queensland, down into northern parts of the Channel Country and western parts of the central west.
Looking long term, the wet weather could be here to stay, and a familiar name is set to make a reappearance. ABC meteorologist Tom Saunders says a La Niña weather event is likely for the Pacific Ocean this year.
So when you have El Niño, those waters are warmer than normal. When you have La Niña, they're colder than normal. And the models are predicting that they'll cool down through the autumn into winter, even passing La Niña thresholds, perhaps through winter or spring. Currently, just over 50% of models predict La Niña through winter, and just over 60% by spring.
But just like with any weather event, nothing can be predicted with certainty.
There is something called an autumn predictability barrier, and the model output this early in the year, so in January, for example, is not as accurate as it is at other times of year. But what does make this La Niña plausible is we've got a negative interdecadal Pacific oscillation that's been in place for about 20 years now. When you have a negative IPO, La Niña years are far more likely. So if the past 17 years, 8 of them have been La Niña, that's nearly 50%, and that's well above the climatological average of 25% of years being La Niña.
So did we really have an El Niño this year?
The Pacific right now is 100% in an El Niño state, and it has been since late winter, early spring. For Australia, though, it only reduces our rainfall in winter and spring. It doesn't impact our rainfall through summer.
The accuracy of the modelling will improve through autumn and winter.
Elizabeth Cramsey there. Well, imagine going along to a major sporting match and being booed by the entire stadium of fans just for being there. It seems most prime ministers these days don't have to imagine. Anthony Albanese copped it last night at the Australian Open tennis final, subjected to howls of disapproval when he was introduced by the announcer. He reckons it's just part of an Aussie larrikin tradition, but could it be a sign of something more worrying for the PM? Rachel Mealy takes a look.
It was supposed to be an enjoyable night at the tennis for the Prime Minister, but when he was acknowledged during the trophy presentation ceremony, the crowd turned on him.
The Australian Prime Minister, the Honourable Anthony Albanese. The Deputy Victorian Premier, the Honourable Ben Carroll.
This morning, he shrugged it off on Melbourne Commercial Radio.
Did you expect that, Elbo?
It's a bit of tradition in Australian sport, isn't it?
It is.
But the Labor Party hasn't always seen it through that lens. When Scott Morrison was booed at an AFL game a few years ago, the party turned it into a social media post which read, "It's sinking in. Scott Morrison is not on your side."
Prime Minister watching on. Russell Gibbs to his left, the chairman of the West Coast Eagles.
Today, the opposition chose to use the event for political gain too. Shadow Immigration Minister Dan Tehan says this is what the Prime Minister should expect for breaking his promises over the tax changes.
Well, when you lie to the Australian people, when you say your word is your bond and you go back on that and you won't even apologise for it, the Australian people are going to view that very dimly. And I think we saw the start of that last night.
Independent Senator Jackie Lambie also sees a political link to the booing, but has a different take.
I imagine there's a lot of people there with quite a bit of money that may have been a little bit annoyed about that they're not going to get the big tax cut they were, but I'd remind those people that, you know, when it comes to our values in Australia, the first thing that we do is we always pass on to those that are less fortunate, and that's exactly what's going on here.
There's a long history of Australian prime ministers being booed at sporting events. Cos Samaras is an ALP pollster and director of the Redbridge Group. He says the boos from last night's crowd couldn't be read as a change in mood in the electorate, more as an indication of perhaps the higher socioeconomic bracket of those able to afford tickets to the Australian Open final.
There'll be more celebrities in the crowd than I would say voters. Equally, there'll be people who are on extremely high incomes. $1,000 is not something the average family out there in Australia that's going to determine the next election result can actually afford, especially in our mortgage belts where people are barely putting food on the table. So I wouldn't put too much into what actually happened there last night. It's typical of any sporting event, but in particular when we're dealing with the Australian Open final, it's a particular type of person that's attending that is not found in marginal seats.
Retired press gallery journalist Malcolm Farr says it's a time-honoured tradition where a crowd gets behind a common enemy.
Can't all of them support or dislike a team, so when a politician turns up, they become the focus points of shouting and booing, and some of it not very pleasant, but usually all good-natured.
He says when Gough Whitlam was booed, it became the stuff of legend.
There's a famous story about how Gough Whitlam went up to Brisbane to see a rugby league match. I believe it was a grand final. And he went on the field with Labor Senator Ron McAuliffe, who was a big deal in local well, National Rugby League. And they walked out in the field and there was this massive uproar of booing. And Gough turned to McCall and said, Senator, if I'd known you were this unpopular, I wouldn't have been seen with you.
But will the threat of a political backlash see our Prime Ministers watch these sporting events from home?
It is a great opportunity to be seen with the ordinary voter, the ordinary man and woman who support a team or support a particular sport, and they would not give that up. They'd be prepared to endure a certain amount of shyacking to be associated with ordinary Australians and their pursuits in the sporting field.
It's journalist Malcolm Farr ending Rachel Mealy's report. And that's the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. And Sabra Lane will be on with AM in the morning. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily Podcast. I think we're all fed up with the amount the supermarkets are charging us, and then there's higher rents, interest rates and power bills. And I know we're going to get a tax cut, but will we really feel less pressure? Who better to tell us than the ABC's business editor, Ian Verinder? Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.